Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a federal commission says we can't eliminate the risk caused by toxic chemicals unless we change our thinking and our laws. How do you get rid of pressure-treated wood? We answer a listener's question. Many dry cleaners use toxic chemicals to clean clothes, but a new process called wet cleaning, no, it's not a washing machine, may be an alternative. We go where the salt and the fresh water mix with author Pierre Bellon as he takes us to the St. Lawrence River. And in our Earth calendar, blooming skunk cabbage stink up the swamps. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Protecting human health and the environment from risks caused by pollution has become a huge enterprise. Vast bureaucracies have been created, including the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, its state and local counterparts, and corresponding health agencies. A national commission, comprised of environmental and health experts, has come to the conclusion that despite these bureaucracies, we're doing it wrong. The problem, it says, is that we rely on a chemical-by-chemical approach. We consider air and water pollution separately, and we do not focus on the overall goal of reducing risk and improving health and the environment. Gil Omen, dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, is chair of the Presidential Congressional Commission on Risk Assessment, which just issued its report.
Our major conclusion, Peter, is that we have an opportunity to move beyond the present regulatory structure where we regulate one chemical at a time, one risk at a time, each environmental medium in isolation, air, water, soil, food. All over the country, as we held hearings for this presidential and congressional appointed commission, people told us, what about mixtures? What about the whole chemical soup that we're exposed to in the air we breathe, water we drink, food we eat, things we touch? And we try to be responsive. We say put each day's environmental problem into context, public health context and ecological context.
So how do you do that? Clearly, we can understand limiting specific inputs, but how do you manage the whole mix?
Let me give you an example. Under the Clean Air Act, the EPA is required to regulate what are called hazardous air pollutants. These are commonly known as air toxics. The present scheme, a departure from the past, is to put best available technology on all point sources, that's industrial and utility facilities that emit to the air, as distinguished from motor vehicles. That process is going forward. But the Congress appropriately said, when all that is done, you must then figure out if the residual risks, that's the risks to people and to the environment, associated with the remaining emissions, even after best available controls, constitute a problem and need to be further controlled. Well, constitute a problem compared to what? Do you do each source in isolation, each chemical in isolation, or do you say what are all the sources of that chemical or that class of chemicals? If, in fact, the remaining emissions constitute a significant portion of the remaining contribution to what we breathe, fine, go for it. But if it's a trivial part compared to what's coming from motor vehicles or from other sources, put that in perspective and deal with the more important or more approachable risks first.
Today, most health standards are based on reducing cancer risk. Dr. Omen says we need to broaden our thinking to look at all risks. Since there are plenty of pollutants out there, like lead, that do a lot of health and ecological damage but don't cause cancer. The report also calls for greater involvement of stakeholders as control strategies are developed. That's communities and people actually affected by pollutants.
Now, the other crucial thing we said in our report, which is a framework, new framework for environmental health risk assessment and risk management, is to put the stakeholders in the center of the process, to involve people, especially local people, from the beginning. Nothing outrageous people more than being told at the end of a complicated process that the decisions are just about made, but their comments are now welcome. In fact, it's not just a matter of right to know or the decent thing to do. We've heard case after case where local people had crucial information about sources of exposure, about cultural practices and behavioral patterns that greatly modified the scenarios of exposure and therefore of risk.
Since we are exposed to contaminants which are generally mixed, Oman says it's more productive to begin by analyzing the impact of what's in the environment around us, such as air with diesel particulates, rather than each chemical constituent of diesel fuel, as is done today. While the need for a more integrated approach to dealing with pollution seems compelling, turf fights in Congress make the task extremely difficult. There are more than 100 committees and subcommittees with jurisdiction over small parts of our separate environmental laws. Legislators and their staffs resist giving up authority to any other committee. This makes it almost impossible to legislate in an integrated way and substitutes subcommittee micromanagement for broad congressional oversight. The report says Congress needs to change the way it does business.
And then we say to Congress, continue the good work that emerged amazingly late in last session when the pesticide provisions of Delaney in processed foods were modified from a zero-risk standard to a reasonable certainty of no harm standard. That's not a number, it's a judgment, but it has been interpreted to be more or less one in a million, worst case. Also, provide authority for EPA and other agencies to consider indoor air pollution. This is a neglected area in the law and an important area of exposure for people. We would like more attention to watersheds and urban areas, let's say geographic areas and not just sources. We ask that the CEQ, the Council for Environmental Quality, activate a much neglected part of the National Environmental Policy Act, the NEPA, that asks for context. And finally, we say to the states and local agencies, don't wait for the feds. Go ahead and do the same thing at the local level.
We know a lot more about how to manage risk, health, and the environment today than we did when our major environmental laws were passed 25 years ago. Dr. Oman's report proposes logical ways to do it. The problem now is how to reorganize the congressional structure so it can function holistically when all the political incentives for a congressman, that's subcommittee chairmanships, publicity, staff, and turf, favor treating air, water, and countless pollutants and individual health problems separately. I'm your host, Peter Burley, and we invite you to talk green on the Environment Show, either by participating in one of our panel discussions or posing a question. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Here's an inquiry that we just received.
My name is Vincent Viola from Cairo, New York, zip code 12413. I'm concerned about pressure-treated wood. I've handled it myself, and there are warnings on it about not putting any food such as fruits or vegetables on it than eating it. It's very dangerous. And what gets me is what happens at the end result. Where do you put, how do you dispose of pressure treated wood when it's so dangerous?
Alex Wilson provides the answer. He's the editor and publisher of Environmental Building News, a monthly newsletter for architects and builders which focuses on reducing the environmental impact of construction.
Almost all treated wood today that homeowners would buy is treated with chromated copper arsenate, or CCA, and that's a collection of several different toxins that are pressure-treated into the wood. Any scraps of pressure-treated wood or pressure-treated wood that's taken out of service should not be burned. Burning it could release those toxins into the atmosphere or put them into the ash, in which case the chemicals would be highly leachable. The only way to safely dispose of it is to put it in landfills, and we all know that landfills are filling up. There's a lot of research going into how those toxins could be safely disposed of. But right now there aren't any real good answers. One of the bits of research that's being done by the federal government is on bacteria that could break down the chemicals in treated wood and selectively remove them. But that research is really at its infancy. There's other work being done on how to reprocess treated wood waste into other usable products, such as wood panels or composite wood panels that would be used in exterior applications. But our recommendation to builders and architects and homeowners is to try to minimize the need for treated wood as much as possible through careful detailing, construction detailing, that keeps wood away from moisture sources so that conventional wood could be used rather than having to use a treated wood. By building on-grade stone patios, for example, instead of wood decks. That's another strategy. Or considering non-treated wood alternatives, and there are some, although they're not widely available. One alternative is recycled plastic lumber that is not going to break down with moisture. Also, in the eastern United States, there are certain highly durable hardwoods that have some potential for use, such as black locust.
Thanks, Alex. Mr. Viola's question about disposing of treated wood is an important one, because in 1995, 17% of all softwood lumber was treated and 138 million pounds of chromated copper arsenate was used. If you have a question about the environment, give us a call and we'll try to find an answer. If that doesn't work, we'll have a panel discussion with two experts who can give you conflicting and opposite opinions. This will leave you more puzzled than you were when you called in the first place. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. Each of us take risks in our daily lives. Sometimes those risks are obvious, and other times they're not so clear. On the surface, dry cleaning doesn't sound risky at all. But most of the time, it requires the use of chemicals which places both the public and the laundry worker at risk. A new process called wet cleaning is spreading across the country. It's safe and environmentally friendly as an alternative. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
If you've ever wondered what that smell is in a dry cleaner, it's perchloroethylene, or PERC, a suspected carcinogen and known toxin. It's not good stuff. Most dry cleaners have technology to keep it in check, but still, a full two-thirds of the 270 million pounds of perchloroethylene used each year by dry cleaners escapes into the air. Sylvia Ewing Hoover is with the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago, Illinois.
The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health recommends that PERC be treated as if it were a carcinogenic. Exposure to PERC in drinking water can quadruple a person's risk of bladder cancer and it increase the risk of leukemia, according to some studies done by Boston University in Massachusetts. And another study done by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health showed that dry cleaning workers employed 5 or more years were at 7 times greater risk of getting cancer than workers who weren't exposed to PERC. On the other hand, there are people in their 70s who will vehemently say that, you know, PERC is all American and they've lived a long and you know, quality-filled life and they've been exposed to it. I certainly don't want to sway people from using a fabric care professional, but I think that consumer demand can certainly help make alternatives available sooner.
Perhaps the most promising of these alternatives is wet cleaning, a process that's reportedly much friendlier to human health and the environment. In less than 2 years, the number of wet cleaners in the U.S. has gone from 10 to well over 100. Converting from dry cleaning to wet cleaning takes a big investment, but it's not necessary to jump in head first. It's estimated that 40% of clothes now dry cleaned could be wet cleaned without making new investments. Ewing Hoover says wet cleaning uses a water-based process that's gentle but effective.
Some of them are citric-based. Some of them have conditioners similar to what you would find in a shampoo. And none of them have a solvent like PERC, which, you know, under the NESHAP, the Clean Air Act, and some other laws, is considered a toxic solvent. And you also don't have the hazardous waste removal costs and concerns and liability that you have when you're dealing with something like PERC that has to be carted away by hazardous waste carriers. So it's their detergents, like soap and conditioner and water. PERC has also been found in breast milk. And so the implications are really broad. There is a debate that's always ongoing just about how much it can harm you and how much of a carcinogen it actually is. But we all can agree that it is toxic, and if there is a way to replace it, it's in everybody's best interest to make a shift towards that that keeps people in business and keeps our community safe.
A wet cleaner opened in Chicago a little over a year ago and cleaned nearly 32,000 garments. 87% of the customers said wet cleaning was excellent or good. In the first year, the store came close but did not turn a profit. About 150,000 workers in the U.S. are at risk from PERC exposure, which does not take into account the people who live above or near dry cleaners. And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says 100 million people are exposed to PERC when it evaporates off their newly cleaned clothes. You can learn more about wet cleaning from Greenpeace, the EPA, or the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago. Give them a call or search under wet cleaning on the World Wide Web. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We all have places which are special to us. City streets, majestic mountains, and rushing water. Pierre Bellon is senior research scientist with the St. Lawrence National Institute of Ecotoxicology in the Canadian province of Quebec. He studied the heartbreaking decline of the beluga whales in the St. Lawrence. Most beluga deaths have come from cancer caused by toxins. But for Bellon, the St. Lawrence remains a river of beauty and grace. He reads from his book, Beluga, A Farewell to Whales.
Our world was a vast expanse on which nothing grew and where there were no shadows to mark the course of the sun across the sky. The track of time was easily lost and no record of its history could be found, even though this world was as old as the earth. It stretched away uniformly in all directions and the unwary traveler lost his way on its unmarked roads. When he tried to retrace his steps, he might find his previously smooth and easy ride turned into a rough and treacherous journey. Traveling through this world was like treading a path as it was being laid out by a fickle mind. Indeed, this realm was but an illusion, a screen drawn over the real world down under. It was the mere surface of the world of whales. Our quest was to understand how beluga whales lived in the St. Lawrence and, as an offering, we had entrusted our lives to the river. From the moment we left the pier at Tadoussac by the Saguenay Fjord, I was overwhelmed by the water as much as by the whales. The freshness of the air, the pristine beauty, and the silent power of the river subdued me. True, I had to sit alert for hours on the edge of my seat to stay on course, while checking the instrument panel and logging in the positions of our captain's observations as shown by the Loran navigator. But life often boiled down to holding the wheel with an idle hand, my head poking out in the sun through the manhole. It would then take me only a split second to leave the boat and queue up with a flock of cormorants or razorbills flying in the distance just above their reflections on the water. The river in that area is a tangle of fresh and salt water streams, the ones brownish, warm, and light, the others green, cold, and heavy. They do not mix readily upon meeting, but roll over each other, producing broad bands of quivering water, like the rips of a tide that moves over an irregular bottom, even though there is only smooth sand and gravel very deep under. At the surface, the water whirls and simmers quietly in the calm, but the slightest wind will turn it into a choppy sea. These fronts progress slowly upstream with the rising tide, then veer downstream with the combined flows of the river and the ebb. Spiraling among them at the surface is a mixture of foam, small organisms, reeds and driftwood from the continent, which will have been thoroughly skimmed by an army of gulls by the time it reaches the ocean.
Pierre Bellon is a senior research scientist with the St. Lawrence National Institute of Ecotoxicology in the Canadian province of Quebec. His book, Beluga, A Farewell to Whales. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Although it's still winter, skunk cabbage flowers are creeping up through the snow in places where early spring is beginning. Skunk cabbage gets a head start on its competitors by blooming at odd times. Tom Crowett is the P.A. Schultz Curator of Botany at the Missouri Botanical Gardens in St. Louis.
It's known as the earliest flowering plant in the United States, and probably certainly the earliest flowering plant in North America. It flowers as early sometimes as November and December, rather frequently in January, even more so in February, and the preponderance of its flowering actually occurs in April and May, but it tends to flower whenever you've gotten a warm period, like we had recently during the middle of the winter. The flowers are actually developed in the summer of the previous year, I mean, so that they're slowly developing, and if you get a warm spell, then the plant can go ahead and produce flowers at abnormal times.
Croat says skunk cabbage can bloom at just about any time as long as the right ingredients exist. It's a mysterious plant that lives in swampy areas. Skunk cabbage can afford to flower in cold weather because it creates its own heat. Scientists don't know exactly how, but it's not uncommon to see snow melted around a blooming skunk cabbage plant.
When it is in flower, it is producing a lot of heat, and the heat is very beneficial to the plant and to its insect pollinators because it can actually warm up the whole interior of this thing and making it a more hospitable place for a pollinator. The temperatures may rise as much as 25 degrees centigrade above ambient temperature or above the surrounding air, and it's capable of actually controlling this temperature. So if you have a really cold day, it will heat up. If you have a warmer day, it will not be so hot. In other words, it's almost like a thermostatic regulator in your house. It's able to warm up or cool down, and it may do this over a period of 2 weeks.
Skunk cabbage is aptly named. It produces the scent of dung or rotting meat to attract flies, which then spread its pollen and seeds. Flies shared this delicacy with Native Americans who ate skunk cabbage and used it for respiratory illnesses. In fact, it was listed in the pharmacopoeia in the 1800s. Crowett adds that skunk cabbage is an incredibly hardy plant that lives mostly underground.
These plants are capable of pulling themselves down into the ground. They grow very, very slowly, and they may be as old as trees, in the surrounding area. And it may only grow between 7 and 10 millimeters a year, but it never grows up above the ground. What happens is that the plant gets pulled back into the muck, and it gets pulled back into the swamp by means of contractile roots. The roots actually shrink and pull the stem back down into the swamp, so that the plant is always growing more or less at ground level. Obviously, a plant that flowered in the middle of the winter, if it were sticking a foot up above the ground, it would certainly freeze.
You've heard about old-growth redwoods and old-growth cypress and old-growth fir trees And now there's old-growth skunk cabbage. If you can find a spotted owl that lives in old-growth skunk cabbage, we want to hear about it. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a homeowner in Oregon battles her state to stop clear-cutting to save her home from mudslides. A federal forester says there's too much clear-cutting worldwide. Garbage and sludge is being shipped across state lines. How would you feel if it wound up in your backyard? We'll talk green. And singer Glenn Waldeck rails against corporate greed and logging. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. A couple of months ago, we reported on a mudslide which occurred above Hubbard Creek in Umpqua, Oregon. It happened on an extremely steep slope owned by Champion International. The mountainside had been clear-cut almost a decade earlier. A house in the valley below was wiped out, and the family that lived there was killed. Before the clear-cut, the homeowner had expressed concern about landslides to the state forestry officials, who took no action. Surviving relatives have now filed a lawsuit against both Champion and the company that felled the trees. Karen Henderson's house is also on Hubbard Creek, adjoining the property that was swamped. The steep slope above her house is owned by Roseburg Forest Products Company. Logging roads have built on it, and it is marked for clear cut. She's begun a campaign to protect herself and her home.
What I'm looking for is the Forest Practices Act to be amended to protect downslope residents.
And have you had any success in getting people to take that seriously?
Not so far. I wrote Bill Fisher, our state senator, and he replied telling me that this is quoting his letter, clear-cutting is a practice that enables a diverse ecosystem to thrive, stronger and healthier trees to survive, and it encourages responsible forestry through scheduled replanting.
And do you think it's encouraging responsible forestry as it relates to the very steep bank above your house?
No, I don't. I'm going to be meeting with the Board of Forestry March 5th to explain my feelings and that I believe the Practice Act should be amended to protect downslope neighbors, not just the timber resource.
Ms. Henderson says the Roseburg Company won't talk to her or reply to her letters. But her advice, nevertheless, to people seeking change is to write lots and lots of letters. While the Oregon State Foresters are still studying whether there is a relationship between clear cuts and slides, Jim Furnish, forest supervisor for the Siusala National Forest in Corvallis, Oregon, finds the evidence is conclusive.
Well, we took a particularly hard look at this past year when we had probably the largest rain event and flood storm that we'd had in the past 20 or 30 years in February of 1995. And so we spent the last year kind of assessing that. And we were particularly interested in the response of both our roads to this flood event, as well as the some of the past harvest areas. And what we found was that there was a marked increase in the both the numbers of slides associated, landslides that is, associated with roads as well as clear-cut harvest as compared to our natural landscape, and also that the magnitude of the slides seem to be larger in many cases.
This has led to a change in management, but the biggest key has been the virtual cessation of clear-cut harvest in the Siuslaw as a result of the Clinton administration's Northwest Forest Plan. Furnish says slide danger lasts for up to 15 years after a clear cut. But in this part of Oregon, slides occur even on slopes that have not been cut. He says these natural slides are different, particularly as they affect salmon streams.
Ironically, the salmon, there's a very close linkage with salmon production and the health of the salmon habitat out here. They really need large wood and a source of gravel that comes from landslides and that type of thing. But to me, one of the stark contrasts between landslides that occur on a clear-cut unit is that they really don't contain any of that large woody material that can be deposited in streams and ultimately benefit the salmon habitat, whereas landslides that occur in a more natural forest setting often include many of these large, older trees that work their way into the stream courses and ultimately will actually help to improve the salmon habitat and help to store and slow down the rate of movement of the gravels and that type of thing, so that they actually work to some benefit. And for me, that this is landslide topography. I mean, they do occur here.
In the long run, Furnish says the time has come to change attitudes about clear-cutting.
With the issue of clear-cut harvesting, whether it's in the Pacific Northwest or in the Brazilian rainforest and that type of thing, we've seen that as a practice, it has the potential to radically alter the natural processes which are at work. And for me, the big lesson here is really trying to pay attention to how nature operates and that type of thing, and take a much more humble and simple approach, recognize that, yes, we do need to use wood occasionally, but to try and do so in a way and with methods that mimic to the best of our ability the way natural processes work. And to the extent that clear-cutting is well outside the bounds of what appear to be natural systems, then I think we should use it very judiciously and only as a tool of last resort rather than a first choice.
Jim Furnish is the forest supervisor of the Siuslaw National Forest in Corvallis, Oregon. We're Talking Green in the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our concern today is garbage and sewage sludge, specifically shipping it across state lines or from one country to another to get rid of it. How do you feel about dumping someone else's garbage in your neighborhood? Or looking at it from the other side, isn't it a good idea to ship your waste someplace else? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We're joined by three experts who know a lot about this. They're Dave Dempsey from Lansing, Michigan. He's policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council, a coalition of 39 environmental organizations which is fighting the import of garbage from Canada. Rich Goodstein from Washington, D.C. He's the divisional vice president for Browning Ferris Industries, or BFI, a leading company in the business of recycling and waste management. And Eric Bach, also in Washington. He's a lawyer who drafted waste control legislation that was introduced in the Congress in 1994. So let's start with you, Rich Goodstein from BFI. What does your company say to people who say they don't want garbage trucked into their neighborhood or into their state?
We recognize that it is galling for people to be on the receiving end of somebody else's waste. Frankly, we don't see it as an environmental issue. Frankly, the sites that waste tends to go into have to meet a federal regulatory standard nowadays. So whether waste is coming in from the next community or from five states away, the environment, in our view, is really not jeopardized. But it does offend people's sensibilities. And as a result, it's BFI's view that waste, when it is received from some remote distance, should usually be received with the assent of the local community. And indeed, that's the posture that we've taken with respect to the federal legislation that has been put forward in Congress.
So, Dave Dempsey from Michigan, you're fighting one of these proposed sites, I guess.
That's right.
How do you guys look at this?
Well, it is an environmental issue. Landfills in the United States and in Michigan are supposed to meet fairly stringent requirements. But I think the real issue is that if you continually import waste from other jurisdictions, you reduce the incentive of both the exporter and the importing state to further reduce and recycle their waste. In Michigan, for example, we've gone basically from about a 5% recycling rate to almost a 25% recycling rate in the last 10 years, and citizens here are very proud of that. In addition to our state having a bottle deposit law, they've made some tremendous sacrifices. When they find out that the landfill capacity they've, in essence, conserved by not throwing away as much garbage is basically consumed by out-of-state waste, it reduces their incentive to further reduce and recycle waste. It also obviously reduces the incentive of exporting community, in this case, metropolitan Toronto, which wants to bring 40 truckloads of waste a day into Michigan, to take care of their own problem by reducing waste. And I must say, it certainly does offend people's sensibilities. There are many issues that, in some regards, are probably more critical, more imperative for the environment that don't get this kind of response. We've had all kinds of citizens call us and say, what can we do about out-of-state waste coming into Michigan?
Now, Eric, you've been involved in drafting legislation that would control this. What is the need for legislation, and how do you think it ought to work?
Well, Supreme Court in 1978, Supreme Court decision stated that or prohibited one state from prohibiting importation of waste from another state. So the Supreme Court found that to be unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. The ability to regulate commerce is under the U.S. Constitution granted to Congress. So Congress, if it wishes, could provide the states the authority to prohibit importation by passing a piece of legislation.
That Do you think it should?
Well, I think one of the things that has to be taken into consideration is the importing state's solid waste management plan. I think it's an important question whether or not the importation is consistent with the state management plan. So apart from the environmental issue, which Rich mentioned, and I think most of the facilities today are environmentally sound, the question is, does the capacity that's used for out-of-state waste undermine the long-term capacity plans of that particular state?
Okay, well, let's go to the phones, and I see we have a call from Sierra Blanca, Texas. Bill Addington, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Hello.
Hi there. What's your question?
Well, I would mainly have a comment, and it would also be a question. I have a question also. Comment would be, I live in Sierra Blanca, Texas, and we are the recipient, I've lived here all my life, of New York City sewage sludge, and it's the largest sewage dump on Earth. There is not one larger. It comes in with a contract with the City of New York, Department of Environmental Protection, and the company's Merco Joint Ventures. Came in without any local approval, and in Texas it's only a registration. There's no permit or public hearing necessary. I believe, and this is the end of my comment, that each state, if not each generator, should be taking care of their own waste, whether it be sewage sludge or proposed nuclear waste that's being proposed, that's being shipped here from other states like Maine, Vermont, into my home here in Sierra Blanca. Keep in mind, this is the largest sewage dump on Earth. There isn't one larger, and we're getting about 400 dry tons of sludge cake shipped by rail. I believe, and I think there was legislation introduced into Congress where a community could have a right to say no. And I think if this sewage sludge is not good enough for New York City or New York State, in fact, we learned that this sewage sludge, because of the high metals, can't be spread anywhere in New York State. But yet, because of regulations that aren't as stringent in Texas, they created, for money, the largest sewage dump on Earth. So my question is, do you really believe that shipping waste across the country, taking a lot of, we're talking a lot of diesel, and of course, is a good idea when it's not allowed to be spread in the host state, recipient state, and we're the recipient state.
Rich, why don't you take a crack at that? You folks are in the business of doing this. How do you respond to Bill Addington from Texas?
Well, we don't do it with respect to sewage sludge, but I'll respond generally. He raises a good point, but I think I would suggest that the question actually proves why curtailing the movement can be a problem. Let's take nuclear waste. Would you think it would be economically and environmentally sensible for every single one of the 50 states to have their own nuclear waste dump? Look at the agonizing effort that we're going through to have only one sited in Nevada. What this gentleman is suggesting is that every state should take care of their own nuclear waste, their own hazardous waste, their own sewage sludge, their own trash. And I think from any standpoint, economic or environmental, that does not make sense. So if you accept that as a proposition, and he may disagree, but if you accept that as a proposition, the question is, okay, where do you draw the line? And I think there needs to be very tough environmental standards to make sure, and I'm sorry that Texas doesn't have those standards, but there need to be tough standards to make sure that wherever the waste is coming, that it doesn't pose a threat to the environment or to the people. And let's not forget, however, that when Dave is talking about the people in Michigan conserving their landfill capacity, my guess is most of this waste is coming into a private facility. It's not their facility any more than the GM plant is their plant. It's GM's plant. When the state of Michigan starts making cars, then it's the state's auto plant. But it's not. These are private concerns right now. What I'm suggesting is, frankly, that landfill operators should be mindful of what the local citizens want. But again, what this gentleman from Texas raised was why, frankly, imposing restrictions can be a big problem.
Well, this is Dave Dempsey. I've got to say, comparing garbage to automobiles is just a non-starter. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has gone along with that to some extent by ruling that the Interstate Commerce Clause applies to garbage. But let's face it, garbage is unique. Waste generally is unique in the hazard it can pose to the environment, as well as the waste of resources that it constitutes. And I think it's inappropriate to say that a landfill is just like any other concern. We have in Michigan,
Dave, let me ask you something.
10,000 contamination sites, and hundreds of those are old landfills.
Is the site that you're concerned with, which I guess is proposed to accept garbage from Toronto, is that privately owned and built, or is that a public facility?
It's a BFI facility.
It's actually a BFI facility. Uh-huh. I see. So, Rich, it's one of yours. How about Bill's Addington from Texas? You're still on the line.
Yeah.
Is the place that the city of the New York City sludge going, is that on a private ground?
Yes, they purchased the land for $4.5 million. The Merco joint venture did. Also, this nuclear waste, this comment about the nuclear waste, saying that we shouldn't have 50 sites, quite frankly disturbs me. In the Northeast, I see a lot of people, and I travel up there, like, for example, in Maine, state of Maine, they have the right for a referendum on building a dump there. I think every town and every state should have a referendum on building any type of nuclear dump. But over there, they have the right referendum to even compact. I went over there, and it seems like some people in the Northeast, not all of them, there's a lot of very good people in the Northeast, believe that the Western states are less environmentally sensitive than their part of the country, which is ridiculous. Nevada is not a nuclear dump ground, and neither is Arizona, Texas, or New Mexico, and we have to get away from the mindset that there's a black hole somewhere in the United States or on Earth that we can just shuck all this garbage into, whether they say that it's least populated or less environmentally sensitive. We better start thinking real hard about the waste we generate and keeping these poisons isolated from the environment responsibly, not shipping them off to somebody else at their expense of their water and their health and human safety.
Okay, well, thanks,
Peter,
for your comment.
I got a couple of comments. The difference between solid waste and nuclear waste is that Congress has spoken as to centralizing disposal of nuclear waste, and they have revisited that issue as recently as last Congress, and it's still the case that it is congressional intent that one site or a limited number of sites be located.
The other point about federal policy here of whether or not a state should be responsible for its own garbage, there is no federal policy in that regard. I don't know whether or not the interstate legislation it passed could be viewed as federal policy that a state take care of its own waste. But there is a federal policy that land disposal, which is primarily the purpose of interstate transport, be the lowest priority in terms of solid waste management.
Well, it seems to me an interesting issue has been raised here, and that is that if a state, and Bill Addington says Texas, allows sludge to be spread that has higher levels of contaminant than, say, New York does, if the state wants to protect itself from that kind of issue, I suppose they could adopt higher standards, but that then
well,
is a local
they
issue.
Did. In fact, the law at the time said that it, that to, for out-of-state sewage sludge, the regulations had to meet the more stringent of the two states, the host state or the recipient state. In this case, it would have been New York State. However, they failed to look at their own regulations because basically what you have is corruption in the state government of Texas.
Yeah, I think the point there is that the state consistently can demand that public health and safety is protected. So if there is any follow-up in terms of the kinds of facility that's used to dump this material, that's really the state's responsibility.
Okay, well, thanks for your call, Bill. And let's go up to Michigan, where we have a call from Jeff Surface. Jeff, where are you located?
I am in Dexter, Michigan, which is not too far away from the BFI landfill, which is going to be receiving all the waste from Toronto starting the 1st of 1998.
So I'm sure you have strong views about it.
Yes, I do. And I want to respond to a comment that Rich from BFI made that BFI likes to get the assent of the local community when they start bringing in out-of-state waste. Well, I severely beg to differ with that. There was no gathering of information, no notification by BFI whatsoever. We were not, there was no solicitation of our comment on this whatsoever. And I would like to know what exactly he was talking about, because it certainly doesn't jibe with what happened here in Michigan. And secondly, he also made a comment about, he was sorry about the way the waste regulations were in Texas. But my comment would be, BFI and other waste management companies in the 1996 election spent well over $1 million in campaign funds to finance various candidates who I imagine agree with their positions on the laws in the, with respect to waste transfer.
Rich,
and I was
sounds
wondering
like
why what they are expecting to get for the, for those many millions of dollars.
Rich, it sounds like you're on the hot seat here.
Yeah, it does. BFI has a competitive advantage by setting the regulatory bar quite high, because the fact is BFI, by virtue of being a big, well-capitalized company, can afford the liners under landfills, the leachate collection systems, the methane control systems that, frankly, some of our smaller private sector competitors and public sector competitors, frankly, can't afford. So if you're asking what does BFI want from policymakers, state or federal, we want to have tough standards equally enforced, because, in fact, we don't believe that the standards are equally enforced. We're under the gun, and a lot of our smaller competitors or public sector competitors are not. So if Jeff can help us advance those policies, we'll take all the help we can get. With respect to our working with the community near this landfill, it's my understanding, I don't keep tabs on every single contact we make at every one of our landfills, but I do believe that there was actually a considerable amount of outreach to local officials. If it wasn't to the point of soliciting comments from the general public, I will confess I don't know, and I'd be happy to speak with Jeff later and direct him to the people who would know.
I'm afraid our time is up. We've been joined by Dave Dempsey, who is Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council, Rich Goodstein from BFI, Browning Ferris Industries, and Eric Bach, a lawyer in Washington. I want to thank you all. We've been talking green on the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Give us a call.
Should the United States support family planning programs abroad? We'll be talking green about the question. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. And our website is www.enn.com/envshow. You can also order copies of this Environment Show. Its number is 371. We've talked about clear-cutting. Singer-songwriter Glenn Waldeck expresses strong views of his own in the song Subsidized Stumps. He takes aim at both corporate loggers and the U.S. Forest Service. Reverence for powerful organizations has never been a part of the minstrel's state of mind.
Tell you all a tale about a tree that came to town. There was no act of nature that cut it to the ground. It was not felled by drought or lightning or flood of driving rain. It was throwaway mentality that flushed it down the drain. Well, I said, don't cut down that tree. It's part of a higher plan. Diversity just ain't your cup of tea. I said, don't cut down that tree. Sit back and let it be. 'Cause if you do, you have to deal with me. Yeah. You have to deal with me. Deal with out where it's pristine. Look, these man-made machines. They cut thousand-year-old giants to their knees. With their jaws made of steel, they don't reason, they don't feel. But they're driven by the corporation's greed. They sure have got some nerve, cutting down the last reserve. With help from our Forest Service, I know that sounds absurd. We subsidize the slaughter with aid from Uncle Sam. We find bon voyage for most of those lives, they're headed for Japan. Mm-hmm. I said, don't cut down that tree. It's part of a higher plan. Diversity just ain't your cup of tea. Well, I said, don't cut down that tree. Sit back and let it be. 'Cause if you do, you have to deal with me. You have to deal with me. There are many mysteries in amongst these ancient trees. From the nitrogen-rich soil to the tallest canopy. They purify the water. They help to clear the air. Provide the food and shelter for species yet declared. The American bald eagle sits atop the highest bough. Its neighborhood of earth and wood is shared by spotted owl. There's flicker, hawk, falcon, salamander, flying squirrel. Yeah, but if we waste this wonderland, they too will leave this world, yeah. Well, I said, don't cut down that tree. It's part of a higher plan. Diversity just ain't your cup of tea. Well, I said, don't cut down that tree. Sit back and let it be. 'Cause if you do, you have to deal with me. Well, I said, don't cut down that tree. It's part of a higher plan. Diversity just ain't your cup of tea. Obviously, I said, don't cut down that tree. Sit back and let it be. 'Cause if you do, you have to deal with me. short-term profit don't make no strong economy. You ain't fooling me. Uh-huh. You ain't fooling me.
Singer-songwriter Glenn Waldeck performing subsidized stumps. It appears on the Glenn Waldeck sampler. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.